She walked off MILF Manor, but no one ever asked why. Until now, Lynette West returns to tell the truth, and uncensored and unafraid, in part two. Stay tuned. Greetings and welcome back to Digital Dating. So last week we had Lynette West from MILF Manor, which was on TLC and streamed on HBO. And we had a great, great conversation. But at the end of the conversation, Lynette said to me, you know, I never got to explain my story about why I left MILF Manor. I think it was like episode 9. She got up in the middle of the night and said to the producers, I want out. I'm done. And she never really got a chance to explain why. So I said, let's do a part two. And you can have an hour to explain why. So here it is, part two. Greetings and welcome back to another episode of Digital Dating. And this is part two of my interview with Lynette West. And I hope that you listen to part one, because you're going to really need to listen to understand part two. You really need to listen to part one. But let's just pick up. We'll give you a little background. So Lynette was on a reality TV show called MILF Manor, which was on HBO. And she was in season two. And I don't know that we need to get into the concept of the show. It's all in episode one that we did, part one that we did. But when we ended part one of this interview, Lynette had felt that she didn't get a chance to explain. So she left MILF Manor in episode 9 on the MILF Manor show. So something triggered her. And I'm going to turn it over. So, Lynette, welcome back to the show. Welcome back to part two.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I am excited. On top of that, we've been bonding over some things that we have in common, everything from tennis to addiction. So, Lynette, you walked off the, almost basically walked off the set, like, because the way you explained it, you packed your bags, and even though the cameras followed you, getting you in the car and all that, something triggered you, and I'd like you wanted to explain why and what happened and all the background. So It's all yours. Tell us all about it.
Thank you. Well, I feel it's important to kind of understand the why behind people's behavior, because I think that leads to a level of understanding and hopefully compassion. And what happened was I was interested in and hanging out with and connecting with one of the dads on the show. And as it turned out, he was looking in other directions while I wasn't. And what I was being told was very different and inconsistent with his behavior. And so I kind of discovered that he had eyes for another MILF. And it just kind of sent me into orbit, because it dug up and triggered all of those emotions from all of my life. The abandonment, the I'm not good enough, the unlovability, the no one's ever going to love me, I'm too much. It's funny. It's like, am I not enough or am I too much? But I'm both of those extremes. And, or at least I feel that way. And I have my entire life. And I didn't really understand why. And I've been working through it, because there were a lot of people, I think, that were genuinely concerned. They're like, girl, you need some therapy. I'm like, oh, honey, I've gotten some therapy. This is progress, actually. You should have seen me 10 or 15 years ago. But in all seriousness, it was an emotionally triggering event for me. And I just wanted to have an opportunity to kind of give folks a little behind the scenes on my life to put some of these behaviors in perspective.
Okay. Before we get to that, I just want to understand, what was the concept of the season two? So, for example, The Golden Bachelor, that show, and some of the other shows where the bottom line is at the end of the show, somebody gets a rose and they go off into the sunset and they get married or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. What was the concept, like, what was the end game of MILF Manor? Was every guy and every woman going to match up and ultimately go off? Or, like, what was... Okay, yeah, so...
More or less. You were there to find love. You were there to find a connection. Whether it be, spoiler alert, with the sons or their fathers.
Okay.
The goal being to find a connection, to have a relationship, to find love. And, you know, not everybody was there, I think, with the same intention, but I was rather naive. I thought I was going to either find love on the show or through the show somehow. I really thought that this was the universe kind of setting me on a path to find my guy. And I do recognize how naive that sounds and how that was, but that's
And the reason I asked that is because in my dating life, there's a couple, there's ways of dating. So if I go out dating, especially these days, you want to date multiple people at the same time, because there's a term called sniper dating, which is like you choose one person and you go after that one person. And I'm kind of doing that right now. There's somebody that I'm interested in and I'm kind of going after her, although she's made it kind of clear that she's not interested, but whatever. then there's the wider range where you date multiple people, and then ultimately you left, maybe after a couple of weeks, you narrow that down from five, four, three, two. So I'm just trying to understand the show. You were when you were there. So this Anthony, that I think was the gentleman's name, that really kind of tripped you up, right? You went on a date with him, and you thought things were good, and then you found him in that bedroom. What was the name of that bedroom?
Roofie room. Sounds like roofie, but it's roofie,
right? It's like, what are we dropping roofies? And that's what triggered you. So was it when you did you not know that he was gonna date other people?
And I get it. Like, you're there to explore. And what the show didn't show is that I had interest in another dad initially. And he and I actually, you know, connected, but it just didn't, it kind of fizzled. And so the show focused on me and Anthony because that was where there was the most traction.
Okay.
So I wasn't totally stupid in thinking, oh, one guy, that's it. I'm putting all my eggs in one basket. I had talked to all the guys and, you know, I felt that there was certainly could be friendships there. But I'll be honest, Anthony was very persistent and he was very smooth. And I chose to believe everything he was telling me.
And then 2 days later or whatever it was, you see him going to the roofie room with some.
Exactly.
All right. Exactly. So it triggered you.
Right.
And then you decided to leave the show.
Correct.
Okay.
That's what I do. It's called a fight or flight reaction.
Oh, yeah. I'm familiar with it.
Fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. And I use all of them depending on what situation I find myself in. Around my family, I tend to fawn. But when I'm in something like that, you know, you don't want me to fight. Okay. Like, that's not a good sign. The collateral damage is too great. And I don't want to go to jail. So I knew that I needed to get out of there. And so flight, it was 2 a.m. I packed my bags. I was like, I'm out. There was no changing my mind. You know, there was no cooling off period. I wasn't allowing anybody to be any voice of reason or sanity. Like, I had made up my mind and I was getting the hell out of there.
Did the producers try to stop you?
Oh, yeah. They were like, no, you can't go. There's no way for you to go. It's, you know, by this time, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Nobody has a car here. I'm like, well, production uses cars to get here. I will just pay somebody, you know, one of the cameramen or one of the production people to take me to a hotel. I am getting out of here one way or another. And so they kind of stalled. And then magically, you know, the black SUV appeared and they filmed it. But I get it. They wanted to document it. You know, I get that. But yeah.
It makes good for the story. So it's drama.
Right. And part of my goodbye interview that is seen on this show, I try to explain that what is normal and comfortable to me is bad. I've had bad relationships with men my entire life. My father left shortly after my parents divorced when I was 6, and I had no relationship with him for 40 years. I did reconcile with him and reach out to him about, I guess it was about 6 years ago now. And We now have a relationship, I'm happy to report, but there was a significant period of time in my life, and certainly during those critical developmental years, where there was no father figure or man in my life. And the one that was, my grandfather, he was there until about, I think he died in 81, so I was 8, 9 maybe. He kind of assumed that fatherly figure role for me and with me, and he turned out to be a bad guy too, so I didn't really have a lot of good experiences with men. And then people are puzzled when I don't have successful romantic relationships later in life.
Define bad guy.
Well, it's my maternal grandfather.
Your mother's dad.
Correct. Correct. He died of cancer when I was 8 or 9. And I remember, you know, the funeral. I remember being really sad. But what I also remember prior to, like, around adolescence, on through adulthood, I would have these memories, and they would be in isolation. And my doctors later called them flashbacks. I called them memories, but they are like a flashback. It would just be like maybe a 3 or 4 second thought, a vision, if you will, of a certain scenario that out of context made no sense to me. And I always would think, that's weird. Like, for instance, when my mother went back to college and we were living with my grandparents temporarily, I had sent her a letter begging her to let us come live with her. And she did. And so they moved us an hour away into town to live with her in Sylva while she went to the university there, Western Carolina in Colloy. And I remember after we got all moved in, my grandfather and my grandmother standing at the bottom of the steps in front of the house, and I'm waving goodbye, and I'm so enthusiastic. I'm excited that they're leaving. I'm happy because in my mind, I'm thinking, I never have to see you again. And this was directed at my grandfather. And I even said to him, bye, nice knowing you, you know? And he looked at me and he said, honey, this isn't goodbye forever. I'll see you next weekend. And my heart dropped and I was like, oh, fuck. And I had that memory and I don't know why I did not want to see him, because as far as I could remember, I loved him. He taught me how to drive. He taught me how to water ski. He was a very loving, compassionate, involved grandfather in my life. So for years, never understood. I just thought maybe I was misremembering something, right? And I probably had that flashback, I want to say, a dozen times over the course of 30 to 40 years. Totally out of context, nothing similar triggering it. It just would pop up periodically. There would be other memories. I have a memory of him lying in his bed, because my grandparents had separate bedrooms. So it was in my grandfather's bedroom. And I remember seeing him lying down, and he had on these pale blue pajama bottoms. And these were like the old school kind that had the metal snaps in the front. And they were open. They were unsnapped. And I could just see like something dark. I didn't see anything explicit or vulgar. I just obviously saw something dark there, like my brain erased what I actually saw. And I would have that vision, and I never, you know, it would make me uncomfortable because I'm like, I remember I didn't want to always go back to his bedroom, but I thought he had bad breath, or, you know, why did I not want to go? I rationalized, and, you know, then I thought, oh, well, it must have been an accident. Maybe his pajama pants actually unbuttoned and I saw something I shouldn't, you know? But then again, out of context, that memory means nothing. It's confusing. Another memory I have is I remember in great detail the lampshade that hung over the bed.
Let's take a step back. So When you would go into Grandpa's room, he would call you in there, or you would go in to say goodnight, or... And well, you'd walk in and he's laying on his back and his pajamas that were open. Was he exposing himself to you? Is that what you think of what was happening?
Apparently, yes. Yes. Now, he worked the night shift, what's called the graveyard shift. He worked at the power plant nearby. So he would come home from work in the morning, and that was like our cuddle time. I would be sent into his bedroom alone, and I would be cuddling with him. And I remember that. But I remember that being like, I remember it being not a bad time. It just was like, oh God, I got to go in there again. I don't want to go in there again. but I would do it because I wouldn't want to upset him or make him feel bad. So in my mind, I rationalized it by thinking, well, it's early in the morning. I probably didn't want to get up and have to go cuddle with him. You know, I was annoyed, but obviously I didn't want to go in there because he was doing bad things to me. And so I remember the lamp above the bed. It was round. It kind of hung out over the bed, and then it had one of those cords that kind of draped down the wall into the outlet. And I remember counting the tassels around the shade. So at some point, I must have just laid there and hyper-focused on the shade. And I would get really frustrated because it was round and I couldn't always remember like where I started counting. So I couldn't remember, well, did I count that one already? You know, did I stop counting here? Shit, how many's there? Let me count it again. And I can remember counting it like over and over and over again. And that's a bit odd. But in isolation, that memory just, I thought, well, I guess I like the lamp. You know, I didn't put anything together with it because it was just this random thought. And I was like, I never told anybody these thoughts. I never felt that I should share these thoughts. They hardly registered on my Richter scale.
So again, just because I don't want to read between the lines and get it wrong. So you're cuddling with him and looking at the, was this during the cuddling time when you saw the lamp, or was this another time?
I have no idea what was going on. I'll be completely honest with you. It's almost like I was disassociating from my body.
Right.
Like whatever was happening to me, I was not aware of. I just know I was lying on my back looking up at this lampshade. And my doctor surmised that it's a disassociation. So when something really traumatic is happening to somebody, it's like you disassociate, your brain disassociates from your body. And that's what I figured was going on, which is why I have such a detailed memory of that lamp, that lampshade.
So what was he, I hate to ask that. You wanted to go down this path. So I just want to try to explore it and understand it. Do you think he was fondling you?
To be honest,
you know, digitally, yeah, or.
I don't know.
You don't know.
I have had memory of it.
Because you're focused on that lamp.
All of the really hurtful, like vulgar sexual things have been erased from my hard drive because my brain determined that I couldn't survive that. So it spared me that my whole life. I never had any memories of being assaulted, or I don't know if I was raped, I was molested. All I know is that whatever he was doing to me was wrong.
Right.
And I didn't like it. And I didn't want it to be happening.
So you shut down and you compartmentalized by just whatever was going on in reality. You were focused on that lamp or something at the moment. Yeah.
Correct. And so I had maybe, I would say, 8 or 9 of these memories or flashbacks, you know, in that same vein. Like I remember just dreading going to his house. I remember when my mother moved to Kalawi to start school that we were living with them, and I was so upset. I wrote her a very heartfelt letter like, Mom, please let us come live with you because, you know, they're mistreating us. They're mistreating us. And it was because I wanted to get away from him. And again, years later, Mom told me, don't you know that's why we moved everybody to Silva? Because you wrote me this heartfelt letter as like an 8 or 9 year old saying you wanted to come live with us because, you know, my parents were mean to you. And I have no recollection of writing this letter. I have no idea what I'm sure my mother probably saved it somewhere. She passed away 6 years ago, and I'm sure it's in her files somewhere. But I have no recollection of it. That's just what I was told. And so, again, there are these isolated memories. And what happened after I got sober, it was the first time in my life. Let me back up. I had a cocaine addiction. It was a problem for about 4 years. And it continually escalated to the point that it was very serious. And I recognized that I needed help. And so I did reach out and I got some help. And I did like a modified outpatient rehab initially. And I got sober, and I was sober for about 2 weeks, which for me at the time was pretty remarkable. Yeah. And working with that doctor, my psychiatrist, the addiction psychiatrist, Sarah Koenig, she saved my life. She is the most compassionate, intelligent, sweet human being that I've ever met. And she kind of taught me how to be compassionate to myself, because I told her things I never told anybody about how my whole life I felt like an alien, like that I didn't belong on this planet, that I didn't belong in this skin. Like it was uncomfortable just to exist. I felt unworthy. I felt like I was ugly. I felt like I was dumb. No matter what I accomplished, I felt dumb. I felt like I was masquerading as a smart person, but I really wasn't smart. And one day everybody would find out. I hated myself. I never said a kind thing to myself. I could get a 99 on a test and I'd be like, why didn't I get 100? Nothing was ever good enough. And that was a lot of my mother's voice speaking to me too, because she was never satisfied either. And I just kind of adopted that. But it was the self-hatred that I didn't realize was really exceptional. I just kind of thought, I guess this is how everybody's just really critical of themselves. No, it was beyond that. And so she opened my eyes to the fact that, Lynette, you can show grace to yourself just like you do for others. And for me, that was a huge realization. And so in my sobriety, for the first time, I was starting to think compassionately about myself. I wasn't proud, obviously, of what I had done, but I was starting to think, you deserve to live. And that's really the first time in my life I ever felt that way. I suffered from depression and suicidal ideations my entire life. So,
and most addicts and alcoholics do.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're drugging and drinking and is to cover up, is to numb. To numb.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. And that holds true for me as well. So this particular day, I happened to be in my bathroom. I was looking in the mirror and I remember looking at myself for the first time without a sense of hatred and going, oh, gross, you're nasty. I actually looked in the mirror and I just said, damn, girl, you know, we're going to be okay. And it was the first time literally in my life I ever exercised an ounce of compassion, love, or any kind of commitment to myself, ever. It was a turning point. And apparently...
And this all happened in rehab.
Well, yeah, I was at home. So I was doing an outpatient rehab.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, same thing. I was going to meetings and whatnot. I went away for 30 days later. But this was the initial get sober period. And... As that happened, I surmise now that my brain was like, oh, wow, she gets it. Like, she's not going to kill herself. We can tell her what really happened. We can frame this up for her. We can make her aware because she's starting to have compassion for herself. She will understand it's going to be okay now. Because I think prior to that, if I had realized what had happened to me, I would have probably offed myself. That would probably have been the tipping point. You know, that would have been enough for me to just say, I'm done. I give up. But your brain is an amazing organ. Uh-huh. It is so far beyond our comprehension, you know, the things it does for survival.
Yeah. And they're still studying it. And it's going to be probably many, many centuries before they completely figure it out. And I just wanted to go back to the mirror thing that I too had. And for the folks listening, I didn't divulge this in part two, but part one, I'm in recovery too. So Lynette and I are bonding over this recovery because we're both in recovery. I had this problem looking in the mirror every morning. I'm going back before my sobriety, before I got clean. If I was on a bender, or just drinking or whatever, brushing my teeth in the bathroom, I had to open up the mirror. I just couldn't look at myself. And it took me long time to get into sobriety and even going through my steps and all that stuff to finally look in the mirror and like what I see. And now I have like these little stickies on the mirrors with little messages to myself just to, you know, God loves you or you're going to be okay today and whatever. Yeah. All these little notes that help. I just wanted to let you know that the mirror thing is not uncommon with us in recovery.
Thank you for sharing that. I didn't honestly realize that, but yeah.
I didn't like what I saw. Just like you.
I get it.
I saw ugliness.
Really, that's exactly, like I likened it to, I looked at myself and thought I looked like the Elephant Man.
Thank you.
Like my filters and my perceptions were just so distorted that It was difficult to look at myself in the mirror.
And it wasn't necessarily the physical attributes that you're looking at. It was just, you're looking into the, so, you know, when two people look at each other, like, especially in person, you're looking, they say the eyes are the windows to the soul. So when you're looking into the mirror, you're looking right back at you. And whether, in my case, there were times when between the alcohol and some of the other stuff, I put on a lot of weight. I was just, I was 100 pounds heavier than I am now. So I really physically didn't like what I saw, because I was like, wow, dude, what? My whole life when I was growing up, I was like 140 pounds. People were telling me I was a scrawny little kid. Now I'm in my 40s and I'm like 220 pounds, whatever. Yeah. It took a long, long, long time for me to be able to look at myself in the mirror and like, or now I love what I see. So I'm sorry. I just wanted to bond with you on that one.
No, thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that. And I completely understand where you're coming from. And I think that was my brain's signal to release what I had pushed down or misunderstood or not had any context for, because what happened next, I liken it to like a PowerPoint slideshow. It was literally those memories, one after the other, after the other, after the other, on like repeat until, you know, I got it. And what it did was it created a context. It created a story for me where the only logical outcome was the realization that my grandfather had molested me. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. I had the most visceral physical response. I immediately started vomiting. It was like I was literally releasing it. And I kind of joke because I was so frantic and out of my mind. I was in my bathroom. It was tile. And I slipped and I in the vomit. And I fell and I hit my head. And I'm laying there in the vomit, not caring that I'm in vomit. And I just start crying and screaming and yelling. And it was the most guttural animal sounds that I had ever heard. And at one point, I really even thought, God, is that me? Am I making those sounds? And it took me, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes to kind of regain my composure and, you know, get myself cleaned up. And And so that is when I first had to start dealing with the reality of what had happened to me. And in those feelings of, oh my God, what is going on, were then followed by a sense of relief and understanding, because then I started looking at my life going, well, damn, this makes a lot of sense. This is why I am the way I am.
It explains a lot.
Understand myself. Absolutely. It started filling in the holes. And I remember talking to my psychiatrist about it. She was not surprised one damn bit when I told her. I thought it was going to be this huge epiphany, right? And I was like, you will not believe what I know now. And is this crazy? Like, I didn't know anyone else had had similar, you know, experience. I thought I was, you know, maybe losing my mind a little bit. I'll be honest. Maybe I was turning psychotic or something. But I told her what had happened. And she's like, yeah, I've heard this before. Like, she agreed. She's like, Lynette, you are a classic survivor of childhood sexual abuse. Like, every personality trait is really a trauma response. And I was like, wow, really? So she wasn't surprised. People in my family, a couple were like, I can see it. You know, but they had a different perspective or experience with him.
With grandpa.
Right.
Right.
Right. And then some did not believe it.
Of course not, because grandpa was, there's going to be many. So I have a cold podcast. I think I mentioned that to you before. And there's a lot of sexual abuse that goes on in the cults, and family members are in denial. They don't believe it. Mm-hmm. They don't want to believe it. And especially if, like, so when you came to all this, this was recently, I would imagine, over the last couple of years.
This was in August of 22.
Okay. And was your mom alive still then?
No, I'm sorry. This was August of 21. I beg your pardon, because I got sober in October of 23. Okay. My mother was not alive. She died June 21st, 2019. So she took it to the grave with her. I'm convinced that she knew about it. I'm also convinced that she was
Really?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was not his first victim, but I know I was his last. And
how do moms let that happen? I just don't get it.
She was a very traumatized woman herself. She lived an absolutely tortured life. She was very narcissistic. She was very, also very intelligent, very hardworking. I mean, it's that dichotomy, right? It's that, what do they call that? Cognitive dissonance, when there's like two different things going on simultaneously. It's hard to wrap your head around. Well, that was my mother. I loved her very much. We had a strained relationship at times, but I know my grandmother knew too. I'm absolutely convinced. And my grandmother took it to the grave as well.
So grandpa's doing it. Grandma knows. Mom knows. Did dad know?
No, my father was not really in the picture. Even when my parents were together, he worked away from the house. They did land clearing for reservoirs and dams and stuff out west. So he was always off on a job site. I mean, he would come home periodically. But he was not in the know. He had no idea, because when I shared this with him, his first comment was, "Lynette, oh my God, I wasn't there to protect you. I did not know, because if I had known, I would have killed him."
Really?
That was his comment. And I believe him. I don't think that he knew. He knew other things about my grandfather that not a lot of people knew, that made it very consistent with this type of behavior. And I won't go into all of that, but he was surprised, because he didn't know that those things were really happening. But once I told him, he too was like, well, that kind of jives with a lot of the things I know about him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Again, I and who knows who else in my family has been victimized, and they don't remember it either, because it was so goddamn traumatizing. They pushed it away. They hid it. If you had asked me the day before that, "Lynette, have you ever been sexually molested?" Absolutely not. Like, I've been through a lot of shit, but I dodged that bullet. And if you had said your grandfather did it, I would have fought you. I would have been like, absolutely not. That is not even a possibility.
But while it was happening, and I think you said this, there were weekends when your mom would say, "You're going to go visit grandma, grandpa this weekend." And you said, "No, I don't want to go."
Mm-hmm.
Those are classic telltale signs of child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
When the
mm-hmm.
child does not want to go
mm-hmm.
to Uncle John's house or grandpa's house, or mm-hmm. or being left with a babysitter. Or so
mm-hmm.
I just...
I've got a story better than that too.
Let's go
there
for
is
it.
A picture. There is a picture of me as a toddler. I couldn't have been more than maybe a year, 14 months old. And I can dig this picture up for you. I've got it in my Dropbox. I don't have it handy because it's a little hard to look at. It was a photo shoot that my family had taken, which included me and my grandfather. In the picture, he's holding me, and me as a toddler, as a baby, I'm leaning back from him, looking at him like he's crazy. I'm like literally recoiling from him. And my mother told me the significance of that photo was because that was the first time I ever let my grandfather hold me without screaming and crying and throwing a fit as a baby. I never let him hold me. I would cry and scream to get away from him. Now, is that because I could sense his energy and I knew he was a bad dude? Yep. Or does that mean he was already abusing me and I knew he was a bad dude?
I think both.
Now, that right there, my mother told me that. She said, "He bit your finger when he was playing with you as a baby, and you got mad at him, and so you never wanted to have anything to do with him." That on my children's lives is what my mother told me.
Gaslight.
And that was that picture that I held on to for all those years, thinking, "Oh, I mistreated him. I was mean to him. I'm so glad that, you know, we got back and I let him hold me." I was not more than maybe a year and a half old. Yeah. Yeah. See, those stories in isolation can be easily explained away. But when your brain knows that you're ready to deal with this shit, it gives it to you in context. And when it has a context, it has meaning. And that is what happened to me. These memories all started coming together. And you know, I had them in isolation throughout the years. Like, I'd have one, and then 2 years later, I'd maybe have another one. And then maybe 5 years later, I'd have another one. Like, they in isolation meant nothing and were easily explained away. But when my brain said, look, bitch, you need to know what the hell happened to you. The world needs to know what has happened to you. Because you got a big damn mouth and you're willing to talk about it. And I got a big mouth and I'll be goddamned if I'm not talking about it. Because nobody else in my family will.
So take me through your teenage years. Mm-hmm. So that grandpa's impropriety happened around, you said you were around 8 or 9?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he died, I believe it was 81 or 82. I was born in 73. So it was before I was 10.
We're going to assume that he was molesting you from the ages of 1 or 2 all the way up till he died.
Mm-hmm.
Most likely. Okay. That's a long 8 years of memories that you suppressed for that lamp thing you kept looking at and some of the other things. So after grandpa dies, and when did grandma die? Shortly after, or was she...
No, she died just a couple of years ago. She lived to be almost 103.
Did you ever have a conversation with her about this? No.
She was mentally, I mean, she was physically there, but mentally not all the way there. And then once I made this discovery, the last thing I was going to do was try to get the truth out of her. Because, I mean, she was 100 years old. She never brought it up. I didn't anticipate getting what I needed from her. So I just more or less mourned the death of her before she died.
Okay. So how were your teenage years? So let's skip from 8 to 10 to 12, your adolescent years, dating. Did any of what you must have shut out what happened with grandpa, because you didn't really remember that until your therapy when you got right?
Right.
You suppressed it, but there had to be something inside of you that knew there, because you kept saying that you didn't look at the, you didn't like seeing yourself in the mirror. So, but tell us about your teenage years, your dating and what, any boyfriend, any significant things that happened?
Mm-hmm. Well, and mind you, my father left too when I was very young. So he left, I probably never saw him again until I was 16, when he left when I was like 6 or 7, 8, very early. And so I had been abandoned by him. Then I felt abandoned by my grandfather because he died. Even though, you know, we have all that other shit, but we're not acting like that's happened, you know. It wasn't until I started getting into adolescence. By the time I was 14, I vividly remember my physical for tennis, the fall of, God, I guess it would have been 87, 86, 87. Whenever I started as a freshman, I was 5'8 and 128 pounds or 125 pounds. I was a grown woman in my body with, of course, the stunted mental capacity of probably a 5-year-old. But anyway, so I started getting attention from boys and I absolutely loved it. Male attention was something I had not gotten consistently or really ever in my life. So what did I do? I did everything I possibly could to please boys. I was very promiscuous, very young. I lost my virginity at 14. And I will say, though, I always had a boyfriend. I always had to have a boyfriend. So I would go from one boyfriend to the next, to the next, to the next. But yeah, I was incredibly like hypersexual, because that I correlated that with, well, if I do this, then I get their attention and I think they love me. And that makes me feel like maybe I'm worth something.
Validation. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that haunted me throughout my life. That haunted me until... It literally, that is why I reached out to my father, because I was, again, having very difficult issues in relationships, and I'm the common denominator and all my relationships are fucking train wrecks. So something's got to give. It's got to be me. And I was like, you know, I've got to stop seeking this validation from men. And then I thought, well, where does this problem originate from? It originates from the fact that my father left and abandoned me, and the one man that was supposed to love me didn't. So I didn't feel worthy of love. Why is some other stranger going to want me if the man who was supposed to love me didn't? That was kind of the thought process, I guess, right? So I had reached out to my dad and we mended fences. I literally picked up the phone out of the blue one day, called him and said, "Dad, this is Lynette, your youngest." I'm the youngest of five. I said, "Your youngest daughter, I need to speak with you and I just need you to be quiet and listen to me." And he was obviously in shock because I hadn't seen him since I was a freshman in college in 1991 when I was 18 years old. So anyway, I just said, "Dad, look, you know, I'm going through some shit. I want to have a relationship with you. I need to have a relationship with you. I need to hear that you love me, that you're proud of me, and I need you to want to spend time with me. That's all I need. I don't need your money. I don't need anything else. I just need those things that a daughter needs from their dad. Can you do that for me?" And he was crying and he said, "Absolutely." And that's exactly what he has done. Every time I'm on the phone with him, he somehow works it in about how proud he is of me. Every time. Always tells me how much he loves me.
You had the classical daddy syndrome or daddy issues. But
daddy absolutely.
But
absolutely.
You didn't not do any. So, you know, I'm going to talk from the male perspective. When I'm on the dating scene, I go out, we can spot the women who have daddy issues. They never had daddies growing up or daddies molested them or any number of things. But you reached out to your own dad and said, "I need you in my life." And he said, "Yes." And about what age was that?
This was about 6 years ago. So I'm 52. I was 46.
Okay. All right. And you guys have a great bond.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
He just had a golf bag made for my daughter. Okay. He's buying her a new pair of custom golf clubs. He is involved in my children's lives. He's in my life.
What did he think about your appearance on Milk Manor?
You know, Dad's funny because every time I call him, he's like, "Okay, what kind of shit are you getting into now?" So he's come to expect me to do these kind of wild and crazy things. And, you know, he just wants to make sure that I'm okay, that I'm not doing anything to jeopardize my job and make sure the kids are okay. And, you know, and then we have a good laugh about it because he's like, "Honey," he's like, "every time you call, I have no idea what you're going to tell me." I'm like, "Well, yeah, that's about right."
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm just thinking back because I had similar issues with my parents. My parents loved me and they were both married until death did them part. And so I didn't have a great relationship with my dad, but every once in a while I'd reach out to him, whatever. So, all right, we got to begin to wrap this up again, unfortunately. Anything else that you left out that you'd like to, like, maybe bridge any gaps that we missed? So with you leaving episode 9 of, how does this tie into everything we just discussed?
Well, I think what it all boils down to are a lot of systemic mental health issues that resulted from this. I was diagnosed bipolar 2 when I was 27.
I'm bipolar 1. Amazing.
God bless you. I know. Those psychotic breaks, man. That scares the living shit out of me. I'm sorry. But, you know, you have to admit, if you're going to pick one, which one do you want? You want bipolar 2.
Yeah, except yes, because growing up it was, but I masked it all with cocaine and alcohol and pills. So for a long, long time. And then once I got into this, I've been in sobriety twice, back in the 90s and then the second time. I've been asymptomatic for the last 10 years. It just seemed to like go away.
Well, because those drugs and the alcohol, they short circuit your brain.
They do.
Like throwing gasoline on a fire.
Yep.
It absolutely exacerbates every bad thing you can think of. But it's ironic because that's what we turn to make us tolerate being in our skin.
Yeah.
It's like a catch-22. You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. But again, the kind of reoccurring theme there is you've got to address those underlying issues, right? And the mental health stuff is of the utmost importance because without your mental health, all this other shit doesn't matter. You know, you've got to take care of, you've got to sleep well. You've got to stay away from these mind-altering chemicals as I sit here and vape, okay? I realize there's hypocrisy going on here, okay? I can give advice better than I can take it. You know, and you've got to acknowledge what's going on with you, because acknowledgement is the first step to recovery and fixing. I mean, you can't fix something you don't know or understand. So, I mean, the past 3 years, that's what I've been doing. I've been understanding and gaining compassion and getting to the why do I do the things I do, because I want to change them. I want to be the better, best version of myself. And I can't do that by being oblivious and continuing to engage in the same behaviors. That, you know, that's kind of the reoccurring theme here. And another one is, it doesn't matter what the hell happened to you. We are not what happened to us. We are who we choose to be. And it is more within our control than we realize. And I hate it sometimes because our brain tricks us, especially when you're in a depression. I've suffered with depression and MDD, major depressive disorder, you know, periodically.
Which is part of bipolar too. Which
absolutely.
Is, yeah.
Bipolar too. It's like we get screwed because we don't get the fun mania. We get stuck with the suicidal depression.
Yeah.
Right?
I had some fun mania.
Yeah. Well,
but
yeah,
it was dangerous too. Because
I'm hypomanic. You know, yeah. I'm a good time.
Yeah, but some of the mania can be dangerous.
Very dangerous.
I put myself in some very dangerous places and positions, but okay.
Absolutely. And I don't mean to make light of it, but sometimes.
No. Yeah, listen,
you'll cry.
July 4th, I'll have 10 years sobriety, and I am in the best place that I have been. Unfortunately, it just happened late in life. I wish I had done this 15, 20 years ago, and I had the opportunity. But mm-hmm. You're still young and you still got lots of good years mm-hmm. ahead of you. And you know what? As far as the vaping, that's the last thing that I gave up. And mm-hmm. to the audience, I just quit 7 days ago. So I'm watching her vape and I'm like,
I'm so sorry.
No.
I know. That's
just cruel. Like the alcohol, I have to learn to live that it's going to be around me. So if I want to go to a bar tonight to meet some friends and they're going to drink, I'm going to have a ginger ale, but I can't. Mm-hmm. And if they all want to go out or they go to like someplace where they're going to vape, whatever, I have to live with that. But the point I was getting at is that for the last couple of years, I went to a lot of cardiologists and I had some hip surgery. I had some heart issues and all of them congratulated me about my recovery. You're off alcohol, you're off the opiates, you're off the drugs. I had to go back on the opiates for the hip surgery, but the doctor was shocked that he gave me some opiates, some hardcore. He gave me some good stuff. And then I only used them for 3 weeks after the surgery. And then I got off them and he was shocked. And I'm like, doc, I take my sobriety seriously. Not one of those doctors said to me, stop vaping. They were like, we don't care about that. And I just don't think there's enough studies done on the vaping now.
I agree.
So in the last week that I've quit, I have already felt much more energetic in my lungs. And I'm playing a lot of tennis and pickleball and bicycling and I'm feeling it. So
good.
When you're ready, you'll get to it. You know, just don't put pressure on you. You're dealing with a lot of stuff right now.
Well, it's like the house being on fire and you worrying about if you put your sunscreen on. You know, the vaping just is like sunscreen. It's not that big of an issue. It will become an issue.
It will become an issue.
In the sun. So it still needs to be addressed. But right now, you know, I'm still recovering from the house being on fire.
Right.
So I'm trying to make sure that that house does not catch fire.
One thing at a time.
Exactly.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
But because I've been in recovery for 10 years, needed to address the vaping because I'm in my young 60s and I know that I already been diagnosed with chronic COPD, early stages COPD. So if I don't stop now, I'm not going to see my grandchildren in 10 years. So Lynette, take us, what's on your agenda for the next year, the next 2 years? Tell us where we can, I mean, we know where we can find you on HBO and all that, but what are your plans for going forward?
Well, thank you for asking. In fact, I had a lunch meeting today with one of the founding members of the Association for Public Speakers. I am trying to start this side gig of getting into public speaking and sharing my story in hopes that I can reach people that may not be in a place to help themselves or they need to hear a story they can relate to and provide them some hope. I'm certainly by no means through or done. I am very much a work in progress, but by all accounts, I'm successful, right? I'm still here. I'm still fighting. But I feel a calling to share my stories of struggle and let people know you can still smile. There is hope. There is joy. No matter what you've been through, people have been through a hell of a lot worse than I have, right? And they're still here. They're still fighting. And I want to encourage others and be a motivation for others to continue their journey, to continue their fight, and know that they are worthwhile simply because they were born. And I don't want other people feeling the way I felt. And if sharing my story can shed some light on that and even just change one person's life or one person's perspective, I would consider it well worth my while.
Two things. Consider podcasting because you can reach a lot of people and you already have that name. And I think you would do very well and you'll get your story out there and you'll help a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Second question. This is kind of a you don't have to answer it if you don't want, but and I don't know your relationship with HBO. Mm-hmm. Knowing what you went through then, would you do it again?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because okay. I don't regret anything I've done because that is part of the path that I needed to be on.
Okay.
I needed to learn those lessons. Everything happens for a reason, especially the bad stuff. You know, it, in the worst case scenario, it's a lesson. If something bad happens, well, I learned. Don't do that again.
If HBO, CBS, NBC, any of the major Netflix, anybody approached you in the next year and said that we have a reality show we'd like you to be on, would you consider it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, really? Good. Okay.
Yeah, I would. I would. Just for the opportunity to potentially reach more people. Yeah. Because I didn't put an act on. I was real. I was genuine. I was who I was. Right. I mean, granted, you know, there were times I was probably on my best behavior because I was aware there were, you know, TVs or cameras there and I was going to be on TV. But when push came to shove, I mean, I, you got the real me. I don't know how to be anybody else. I just know how to be me.
Mm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to say before we say goodbye?
No, but I just wanted to thank you again for the opportunity to share some of this. I know it's not always easy to hear, and you might have to put up a trigger warning on this episode. But thank you. Thank you.
I have I'm closing in on 300 episodes, and I've had a lot worse.
Okay.
This was a very educational and very inspiring interview with you. And to the audience, we were just planning one episode, and at the end of the one we just said we can talk for another hour, and here it is. We did a second hour. We're coming up an hour too. So and yes. Lynette, I want to leave an invitation open to come back. So should something land in your lap, like a project that you want to promote or another reality show, a book, a podcast, something comes up and you just please, I'm going to follow you. We'll follow each other. Stay in touch. And I'd be more than happy to have you back again.
Thank you for the support, Andrew. You're amazing. Thank you.
My pleasure, really. And to good luck and success with your sobriety. And don't worry about the vaping. Enjoy it for now.
For now.
All right, everybody. Lynette West. And I think one more time, just tell them where they can find you on, I think it was Instagram.
Lynette.West. It's not creative. It's not creative.
It's Lynette.West on Instagram. So, all right. I'll put all that in the show notes. So, thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
I think we'll see you again soon. Okay.
I hope so. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And that wraps up part two of my conversation with the one and only Lynette West. Huge thanks to Lynette for coming on the show for 2 weeks in a row and sharing so openly and vulnerably. There was another word in there I couldn't pronounce. Folks, 3 podcasts in 1 week, and this week has been a particularly like hellish week, and I love doing this, but sometimes the brain just doesn't want to work. Anyway, Lynette, thank you. You came on, you didn't know who I was, and we did a recording and it was awesome. And we connected and we clicked. And then you came to me and you said, but I didn't really get a chance to tell my story. And I felt bad because I kind of maybe just took you in a different direction. And the very next night you showed up and we finished part two. And it was a success. And I really thank you for that. So to the audience, if you enjoyed the 2 weeks of Lynette West, and I hope you really did, please go down below and leave us some feedback. Leave Lynette feedback. Give myself some feedback. Of course, 5 stars and follow the show and subscribe. Lynette's appearance is going to be on YouTube. Part one is already up there. So if you want to see what she looks like, go check it out on YouTube. And yeah. And I have I have like 15 interviews in the can that I can't wait to get to you. And some of them are really, there are 2 people that I follow on podcast. I follow a lot more than that, but 2 people, I'm going to tease you. I'm going to say 1 or 2 words. It's called Ask Women. That's all I'm going to say. And that's like a little hint of what's coming up in the next couple of weeks. So check me out. Check out Paul Bauer, Come On Man podcast. He's one of my mentors and he's an affiliate of mine. And Podmatch, thank you for the Podmatch. And it's in the middle of the summer, guys. I've launched a new website. I've launched a new blog. There are 2 other podcasts I have, which is Cultimatum and The Weekend Rant. So go check everything out. There's an all new, brand new Anonymous Andrew podcast stuff. It's called the Anonymous Andrew Podcast Studios, and we're doing a lot. And I want to thank my co-host, Melody. She's doing everything with Cultimatum. The only thing I'm going to shout down to is Riverside. Riverside recording platform. You suck. It just comes down to that. You really just suck. So, but I'm not going to ruin Lynette's episode by being a bummer. But if anybody else records on Riverside and you have problems, let me know. Lynette, thank you. And to everybody else, thank you. Spread the word. Anonymous Andrew, digital dating is alive and well. We're going right through the summer. We're going to do a lot more episodes. And until next time and next week, ciao.